show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. Text us that same number. And it's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And Tom, I know you've been waiting for a long time, but before we go to you, this ties in. We're talking about lobbyists and all of those things and the impact of that on your and my life. The FDA lists 378 hand sanitizers to do not use in this country. How can there possibly be 378 hand sanitizers that are being sold on the market and there's an FDA and we, the American people, go in and buy a hand sanitizer that's on the open market, that we think it's on the open market, it's okay, and then we find out it's not okay? That's the stuff I'm talking about.
Just listening to this, Carl, he, she is thinking about organizing the hand sanitizers of America to form an interest group to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again. No, I mean, that's, to be honest, I'm just trying to personify.
No, I get it.
But that's good. The FDA is doing its job. I mean, hand sanitizers.
But shouldn't they do it before it gets on the market?
Well, we remember we had COVID. We had a shortage of hand sanitizers. We had tequila manufacturers who were using their distilleries to make hand sanitizers. I mean, we were very short of hand sanitizers. And so, yeah, there was a flood of people chasing both the welfare and the money associated with that.
So it's still hard for me to understand. So we're worried about COVID killing you, but we'll put some stuff in hand sanitizer that you put on your hands and then put your hands in your mouth and poison.
Well, I think the problem was actually stuff that would soak through your skin, and there was a discussion of it at the time. But, you know, actually, we can be critical of it. It sounds like the FDA is doing its job in this circumstance.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
All right, Tom from L.A., man. Thanks for waiting, man. A lot to talk about.
Guys, yeah, like I said, you know what? The biggest problem, and Sandy, I understand the marketplace, but like Earl said, this stuff should not even be getting out to the market. And it's all about money and politics. It's lobbyists and politics. If you look at the difference between how many lobbyists were in Washington before Ronald Reagan and how many lobbyists are there now, we're basically, you know, the lobbyists are basically the government right now. In terms of, you know, 80% of the people, 75% of the people want Medicare for all. 75% of the people want gun safety laws. The American people are ahead of them, but the thing is they can't get anywhere because of Citizens United. And one thing I'd also say is that people really need to understand the difference between private and public. Dave was talking before about a realtor and how it is that they can't say, you know, master bedroom or whatever it might be. Well, I'm sorry, but if you're a smart business person, you are going to do what it is that's best to reach the most people so they can buy your products. So if that means you change your vernacular in terms of what it is that you say, you're not saying that because of the government. Government's not telling you to do that. You're doing that as an individual business because of the fact that you want to get that market share of people to go towards your product. So, you know, that's just on a privatized type thing. And I get real tired of people not knowing the difference between private and public and blaming government for things that are happening within the private corporations. Private corporations can do whatever the hell they want. That's the whole, you know, issue here.
But
all goes back to money and politics.
The fact that they can do whatever they want, and I have no problem with that, but then if it impacts the American people, there's something wrong with that.
Well, he's talking about two different things.
I agree.
Yeah. I mean, he was talking about policies within a company or with their advertising policy. I mean, yeah, that is the difference between private interest and public interest, things that have an impact on the public broadly. Adam Smith saw that and said those have to be regulated if the marketplace isn't doing the regulation. So, and we have the tools for it. But like I've said, money in politics is giving our political system pancreatic cancer, and we've got to, it's a silent killer, and we've got to bring it to the front and make sure that people see that, because the answer is not to get the government to impose. First of all, how are you going to get a government that's hidebound to K Street to do something against the interests of K Street, right? So in order to unlock government, in order to unlock government today, we've got to get money out of politics, and it's really got to start with reversing Citizens United and waking the public up to the fact that we've got to force sunshine to be shined on politicians. And if politicians want to
like I said, that's what the donors and all these people are afraid of, is that the American people will wake up and see what the hell is going on. That's why they do the whole woke thing, and they work it in reverse, so it shuts down communication. But honestly, the thing that we need for the American people to wake up and realize that money in politics, because I'm guessing most people probably don't even know about the Citizens United decision or why it was 13 years ago.
And then all of a sudden,
13 years ago, why we see more commercials on TV about politicians running for office. And then, of course, the media, they get money from advertising, so therefore they're not going to say a word about this whole thing. It's just got to be every day.
Here's another thing. New study finds high levels of forever chemicals in freshwater fish across the United States. People consume freshwater fish, especially those who catch and eat fish regularly, are at risk of alarming levels of PFAS in their bodies. People are eating fish. They don't think there's any problem. They're catching them. It's just a sport. It's a way of living. People have done since the beginning of time. They think it's safe. They don't realize people have been poisoning.
Well, here, let me just say, though, this. What we need to do is make sure that our regulatory agencies are empowered to deal with new science, okay? PFAS were not an understood chemical 10 years ago. I did environmental law early in my career and was at a time when PCBs in the 50s and 60s, PCBs were viewed as very safe chemicals, inert, not a problem. They were employed in lots of ways for safety purposes. No one understood the problems associated with it. Same with TCE, the trichloroethylene that was used for dry cleaning and stuff. Science then caught up with this, looked at it, realized, my God, this stuff is carcinogenic. They didn't know it was. Then they knew it was. Then it needed to be tightly regulated. That's the same thing that's happened with forever chemicals. People didn't understand.
But now they do understand. Sandy.
Now it's time to regulate and to take action that's affirmative.
Yeah, because they're still using.
Yes, and that's where we have to make sure that money in politics doesn't restrict our capacity to now take the right reactive reaction to the newfound evidence to make sure that we protect ourselves.
But Sandy, that's exactly the issue, is that, okay, the regulatory bodies themselves, you know, you take someone that's a politician, then all of a sudden they get into a regulatory body, they get a job as a lobbyist. I mean, this is the regulatory body itself is now poisoned by money and politics, because of the fact that they're doing what it is that is going to get people elected. This whole thing is all about money and politics and lobbyists and politics.
So, but at the end of all of it, and my issue is that, yeah, I get it, money, okay? Money. And that money
greed.
But that money has more value than people. And
it does, apparently.
Well, it's not apparently, it's true. And so, you know, the value of people is only to their loved ones. It's not to anything or anybody else. And so what if your loved one has died of diabetes? And so what if they can't afford the increase in the cost of diabetes, of insulin? It doesn't matter. The people who are making the money don't care. You know, maybe you shouldn't have eaten what you've eaten to wind up with diabetes. But there's nobody saying.
No, actually, the diabetes thing is more nefarious than that, because they'll increase the price of insulin, but they'll also make sure
that more people are going to attract it.
That it's covered by Medicare, Medicaid, or insurance.
Because they'll for sure they're going to make their money.
Well, then they make their money. They don't make their money if people can't afford it. So they're going to make sure they afford it. What's that going to do? That's going to hurt everybody else who's now going to have to suffer the increased cost of health care to be born and spread out. So this is much more invidious than you're talking about. And it isn't quite as malicious as it is invidious. The arguments that are made.
So I don't know what invidious means.
Invidious means it ends up badly, but it might end up badly without the malicious purpose that you would see as causing as trying to create the result that results from it. So you end up with people pursuing on behalf of money a particular position. They will always color that argument in terms of jobs and people. They will be able to tell the politician and fill the politician with a bunch of arguments that sound like public policy and even sound like sound public policy, like restricting these forever chemicals today is going to cost 100,000 jobs. It's going to have this hugely destructive impact, and so we have to go slow, okay? And I'm just concocting the argument quickly, but I guarantee you that's the nature of the argument that's being made. And so then you have a public policy in mind that a politician has to weigh this against that. They got to weigh Tom against Mary. And so it's a whole process. And the politician begins to feel legitimate about what they're being asked to do because they're being armed with arguments that appear to give legitimacy to it. And the outcome, however, is this invidiously bad outcome.
But never mind the people dying. Okay,
well, because they try to focus the spotlight on the people who will be damaged by the policy. I'm just saying,
it isn't done
with all that you're describing. They usually arm the politician with rationalizations and seeming good public policy arguments, and then go ahead and do it.
844-967-2789 is the number. It's Monday. That's Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And you know, Sandy, I was going to move on, but we'll take this last caller. Put them on the line, Connor. Who do we have on the line?
Oh, this is Jake from Eureka.
Yeah, what's going on?
Hey, Harold, now I just want to add that, you know, Republican Party conservatives generally love lobbyists, corporate lobbyists.
So do Democrats,
remember,
man.
The scandal.
I'm telling you, this is both
do,
ways.
Not to the extent that the Republicans have done it traditionally with people like Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay. I mean, these people, you know, done a lot of criminal stuff on the lobbying side. It's almost like clockwork is that anytime one of these Republican politicians leaves Congress, they go straight into a lobbying job for some corporation to try to get rid of regulations.
Do you think that's only Republican?
Oh, no, it's not only Republicans, but it's pretty much damn near every Republican politician who leaves office, they go straight into a lobbying job. It's like way overboard with the Republican Party in terms of corrupt lobbying for corporate violators.
I think the truth is that most lobbying groups that are big in Washington have about a 50% representation in their ranks of Democrats, and you know, they want to be able to talk to both sides of the aisle. Lobbying's a business, and they're making business type decisions. And quite frankly, the problem with money in politics, like Earl was saying, I think resides on both sides of the aisle, and it's not as clear cut as you think. Lobbyists spend their time artfully developing public policy arguments on behalf of their clients, and it's always about jobs. Almost always, you can pit jobs against restrictions. You can pit jobs against almost anything. You know, lots of people employed making guns, I suspect. So we ought to understand that it's not quite as simple as you think. And the best way to get at this, I think, is to restrict money getting into politics. And it's flowing from both sides, and it's flowing to both sides. And so Tom has right. And the problem with getting money out of politics is which politicians are going to champion this thing that runs against the interest of the people who are financing their campaigns. And it's getting harder and harder to find those people. I said to Earl off the air, I said, you know, if Bernie Sanders had been 15 years younger and looked like JFK, there would have been a charismatic leader who might have, you know, because I think it's going to take charismatic leadership in a movement that is bigger than a movement of politicians who are going to throw off the shackles of what they're shackled by, which is fundraising. Every politician will tell you that they're dismayed once they get elected, because they thought what they were going to do was public policy, and what they do when they get to Washington is they get told that half of their days every day will be spent on the phone raising money.
You know, Sandy, I wanted to, you know, we can't ever get out of here without talking about Ukraine and what's in Russia and what's going on. And I was listening to a lot of different things over the weekend, and there was a lot of conversation about Ukraine on many of these shows, and which is something I haven't heard in quite a while. I'm wondering why the conversation on Ukraine is being ramped up now. For instance, the fact that, and I forgot what show it was on that we're talking about, General Milley,
mm-hmm.
And they were asking him about, you know, the tanks and all of the things to escalate this war. And there's a reason still why, even though the United States continues to invest money, there's certain things she just won't do and go all the way. And that's for the tanks and these jets. Why do you think that we'll do all these other things, Sandy, and continue to feed money into Ukraine, knowing that without these fighters and these tanks, they're not going to be successful in the end? Then why do we continue to invest this money and the military armament if we're not going to help them win this in the end? What's the purpose of that?
Well, a year ago, before the invasion, you and I were talking about this, and I was shaking my head saying that I didn't think the invasion would occur because I thought there would be a negotiation and that what Russia wanted could be satisfied in all likelihood, not with a new government in Ukraine, but with neutrality and a Crimea, a recognition of the annexation, etc. I still think that the terms of the settlement will involve a recognition of the annexation of Crimea and some different treatment of the Donbas region and its autonomy. And I think the reason that we are unwilling to go all the way is that we aren't willing to put ourselves in a direct conflict with Russia. Jets would almost certainly, apparently, we think, get us there. I'm not as clear in my mind why we think that Abrams tanks would make such a difference. It could be that we don't want our Abrams tanks to fall into the hands of the Russians.
And although, they can just find out.
Although I'm pretty sure that it's pretty hard to keep a secret about what our technology is in our tanks. We have thousands of them. And
parts from different parts of the world.
Yeah, so I'm not as clear in my mind why we're putting that restriction on, but I'm confident, and also based on what Milley was saying, where he said, look, the Russians aren't militarily going to be able to overrun Ukraine and take it over, and the end game doesn't work anyway. They'd have to occupy it, and what a problem that would be. And the end game for the United States on our side, and Ukraine is also problematic. We can talk about this in a minute. I think we're going to come back.
Yeah, we'll come back. We'll continue this conversation on the other side. Sandy Williams, it's Monday with Sandy Williams. Always great to have him in and have the discussion. You can join us at 844-967-2789. We'll be back. Join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And you know, Sandy and I always, you know, we're going to talk about Ukraine and what's going on, as we have since the very onset of this. And I've been always, you know, kind of allowing Sandy to give us a better understanding of what is going on there, because many of us want to support the Ukrainian people because, Sandy, we see a people who didn't deserve to be invaded, and we saw ourselves.
Yep. And let me just equate it to something. In the first Gulf War, we invaded from Kuwait, Iraq. Colin Powell was in the lead. We had initial limited resistance, and then we had no resistance. We had a clear path to Baghdad. And there was some hue and cry in the United States, let's take this awful guy Hussein down, let's go to Baghdad. And Colin Powell basically said, if we take Baghdad, if we do this, then we own
it. You break it, you own it.
We break it, you own it. And if you own it, what are we going to do with it? And then everyone stood back, and the real politic grabbed a hold of us, and we said, you're right. We can't occupy Iraq. What are we going to do with this? No, it's time for us to get out. And that's the problem with the situation in Ukraine. I'm not making a value judgment that says that Russia had a right to or otherwise was good to invade Ukraine. But they had a political and a socio-demographic and real politic outlook that to them made Ukraine seem an existential issue. Ukraine and NATO to them apparently seemed existential. They kind of proved that by putting so much blood on the line about it. I mean, you don't do to yourself what Russia's doing to itself right now, which is really shooting its toes off in the process of trying to prevail over Ukraine. I think they miscalculated. I think they thought they could beat Ukraine quickly. But here's the problem, and it was from day one. The problem is endgame. And the end game for Ukraine isn't changed now after almost a year of war from what it was before the war started, and it won't change by another year of war. Russia is going to give up only over its essentially dead body, the Crimea and Sevastopol. It really believes that's geopolitically strategic and theirs, and it's small wonder. Sevastopol really isn't important. To have a warm water port really is important to a country. Soviet Union always had it, and the Romanov Empire had it since Catherine the Great. So this is something of historic importance to the country that views itself as Russia. And so they aren't going to give up Crimea. And by the flip side of this, I don't think the West is going to allow Russia to overrun Ukraine. And Ukraine is probably as smart, I mean, Russia is probably as smart as Colin Powell, and they know they can't occupy, if they break Ukraine and take it over, what are they going to do with it? They can't occupy it now. They've created a nationalism and a nationalist fervor that would cause guerrilla war and terrorism. They could never overcome that, not in several lifetimes at least. And so whereas they thought they could topple Ukraine quickly, they knew that Ukraine had a substantial number of Russian sympathizers within it at the beginning of this war. But I'll tell you what, the number of Russian sympathizers that have survived the war so far is vastly diminished. And whereas there might be plenty of people in Ukraine who question how long this war with Russia ought to go on, there are far fewer people in Ukraine who are supporters of Russia at this point in time.
You know, Sandy, the American people were not in tune to what is happening because we're dealing with our own lives. You know, early on, this was, you know, surprising. It's still going on. We're not focusing on it. But as we move towards the spring and things ramp up even more, the American people are going to be forced to pay attention to this.
Well, it wasn't surprising to the world. Let's put it that way. The world maybe was astounded that Stalin went ahead with it. But Germany and plenty of other countries were worried about the situation in Ukraine and were not feeling as compelled as the United States to, for instance, invite Ukraine into NATO, because there were some who had a better feeling, a better sense of what Russia's reaction might be to that invitation. But now we're where we're at. My suggestion is that everyone focus on this endgame issue, that our politicians focus on it, and understand that the endgame is a difficult thing in Ukraine. Neither side is going to get everything they want. And if we fight forever in the name of, for instance, Ukraine taking back Crimea and Sevastopol, we're going to get mired in something that is going to be in a $1 trillion war.
Well, you know, Sandy, wars have gone on for years, right?
Yep.
That war has actually gone on since 2014.
I think this war would only have to go on for 5 years or so, five times as long as it's currently gone on, to probably get up to the $1 trillion number if you add up what we have given and what all the other countries have provided. This is going to be and is an enormously expensive conflict. And we ought to understand that there are certain things, even though Ukraine is talking about wanting to take Crimea back, I think they're saying that because they need to say that before they sit down on a negotiating table. I don't think anyone realistically thinks that's a realistic objective.
So, Sandy, all that blood has already been shed, and emotionally, from Zelensky's perspective, you can understand why he's saying, I don't even want to have a conversation or a dialogue with them. They're attacking civilian targets. They're doing this. They're destroying, our energy. But that's war, right? Do you do war in a sanitized situation when the war has gotten to the degree that they're at?
Well, no. Unfortunately, I think we, the United States, would be subject to a lot of criticism if we were to analyze the kind of collateral damage that has occurred in the war zones where we have participated.
Shock and awe.
And so I think we need to understand that a lot of this is what happens in war. There's a victim and an evil aggressor, and there's two of them because each side says the other side is the evil aggressor, and each side claims the victim status. And so we just need to make sure we're looking out for the American interest. What is America's real interest here? What should we be doing about it? What should we be doing about analyzing what it is that affects America's real interest so that we don't spend, if we start expanding, for instance, now there's talk about what it is it would cost. Our munitions manufacturers aren't ready for a war with China. We aren't ready to have a war with China. A war with China? I mean, really, we ought to evaluate our conduct in international affairs and stop bringing the world to the brink of wars that cause us to have to arm ourselves against, spend money on defense for, and in expectation of wars that would have an expense that exceeds even our massive GDP's capacity to absorb it without costing us child daycare and welfare and the welfare of our American people.
So let's put this on the table. Because at some point in time, that question has to be answered. What is our interest? It can't be, we can't allow a sovereign country to be overthrown. You can say that, but how many countries get overthrown each year? And how do you get the American people to say, we're willing to pay the cost for that?
Well, interestingly, if we had not probably been arming Ukraine and setting them up to have to negotiate with the power of the armaments that we were giving them against Russia.
This would have been over.
It would have been over without a toppling of a government. The government might have just changed in a manner like the Georgian government did, which was with some military pressure from Russia, but we sat on our hands for that. But we should understand that the real politic, you know, Henry Kissinger was the champion of that. And we forged a detente with China in 1971, because he identified that he could put a division between China and Russia that would isolate Russia. And so when we jumped in bed with China, were we jumping in bed with someone we favored? You know, were we very worried at that point about the communist status of China? Incidentally, in 1971, this was pre-Tiananmen Square. This was before China had revealed all of the problems that it had, but it was after we understood that China was run by Mao Zedong and that the country under Mao was not governed in the way that the United States would favor, okay? So since when have we decided that we would adopt foreign policies that were strictly premised on some ideological principle? Ever since we've started talking about international affairs and carrying it out in that manner, we've carried out some things that have been very damaging to the country, our country, and the country we focused our attention on. Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, those countries did not benefit, and in the end, from what we did on their behalf.
You know, Iraq has never recovered.
Oh, Iraq is a vacuum of power. We've turned it into something closer to Somalia, which is a wasteland, an ungoverned wasteland.
And when you think about what it was, right? Whatever you thought about Saddam Hussein,
yeah,
what Iraq was when he was in charge was a burgeoning economy, and clearly the Iraqi people lived well. Certainly, they lived under dictatorship, but we didn't mind. We knew who Saddam Hussein was.
Well,
but what we did know.
Yeah.
Is that he would keep Iran in check.
Well, in fact,
so we chose
Saddam Hussein was someone that we assisted.
Yes.
He was a U.S. arms purchaser, and he was at one of our client states early in his regime. And so, you know, we have to just look at how we conduct ourselves and what we do, and we need to ask ourselves that question that Colin Powell asked himself. If we break it, what are we going to do?
So
with
when
it?
You talk about the history of it, when you realize that the war between Iran and Iraq, over 1 million people died, and we supported Saddam Hussein, we armed him. So we knew what he had. That's why when George Bush II said he's got weapons of mass destruction, it was because they knew we had given him a lot of weapons to defeat Iran during their war. So we did know who he was, right? And he was our ally. But yet, during that time, they were able to really kind of westernize Iraq.
Well, I really don't know that much about Iraq. Iraq was someplace over there run by this guy, Saddam Hussein, yeah. And the capital was
I did because of his war with Iran, but anyway,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, they had the longstanding war with Iran, but I just, and he did, they did have an organized government with an organized economy, and, you know, basically he stepped into a trap that we found unacceptable when he started fiddling around with the oil in Kuwait, which was American licensed oil operations.
Well, I know, but he said that's mine.
Well,
Ukraine and Russia.
Well, he also they were doing this angle drilling and they were sucking oil out of the Kuwait oil fields and there were some ambiguous conversations that were had with you. Who knows?
I know
the whole thing was. But all I'm saying is that when we aren't careful about evaluating our real interest, and evaluating this question of if we go in and if we break it, what are we going to do with it when we take it over? And we've got that problem in spades in Ukraine right now, because the end game here is very complicated, and it's not a simplified NFL victory, okay? And it's not even a tie.
All right, 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. It's 844-967-2789. You text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams and Sandy Manatine flies. But I have to tell you that this conversation about the war, and pretty soon it's going to be sucking the oxygen out of the conversations, whether or not we want to have this conversation right now in this country or not, either today or tomorrow, this nation is going to have the conversation, because if we keep investing more and more and more and more and more, you know, you can say, well, because I was reading something the other day, it said, well, we've agreed to put $2 more billion. Well, $2 more billion, you know, $1 billion is a lot of money, but clearly not when you're talking about a war, the magnitude of what is happening between Ukraine and Russia. So we're putting a couple, it's like a Band-Aid, right? If we were seriously going to invest, and I think they kind of know, you can't say, well, we're going to put another $50 billion in, you know, Ukraine. Let's do this. Let's bring CJ up quickly. CJ, go ahead quickly.
I always get quickly.
The show's been on for almost 3 hours. We got 5 minutes left, so quickly.
Okay, 18 resolutions Saddam Hussein denied the UN. And finally, someone had the balls to stand up to Saddam Hussein after the UN did nothing, and Saddam was not forthcoming. But the thing of it is, now we have a president who watched the buildup, caused the buildup by his actions, $85 billion in equipment left in Afghanistan, a very strategic Air Force base. Now there's starvation going on over there, and we'll be back, just like we were in Iraq, because Barack Hussein Obama had to re-enter Iraq.
CJ, how do we wind up in Afghanistan, CJ? Under who? How do we wind up there?
Well,
and why do we stay so long? Under who? Who created that?
He listens to his military advisors. This president didn't, Earl. Why don't you ever discuss that? Play back the where General Milley said, you know what? We did advise the president to keep 2,500 there, and he didn't listen. He threw those military advisors under the bus.
CJ, how long were we in Afghanistan? Well, CJ, how long were we in Afghanistan?
Actually, wait. Let me referee here. We've already had this conversation a bunch of times. We're talking.
And you're in denial too, Sandy.
Well, I haven't denied.
Did Milley give the president advice to stay?
Apparently he did. Apparently he did, and I think he got advice from various of his generals and other military.
But the president lied about that advice, didn't he?
CJ, he the president didn't lie about it, I don't think, but in
he
any
did
case,
too.
Cut him off, man. Yeah. Cut him off. Cut him off.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how can you have a conversation with somebody?
Well, here's the point. I don't think we should rehash the facts like that. You know. Yes, all of what he said might be facts. Although I think there is a definite question as to whether the $85 billion number is the right number. Number two, he used to recite the fact that the Air Force base was in the hands of the Chinese, except there was no evidentiary basis for that whatsoever, and it's not true. And so, you know, I think all of that is okay. You know, but even given those facts, let's talk about other facts. Let's talk about today. Let's talk about the situation we face in Ukraine. Let's talk about the situation we face today. I am critical of the current administration's approach to Ukraine because I think the November 10th edict that they gave, the contract they set up that was an invitation to Ukraine to join NATO, was inflammatory and might have caused this. Incidentally, CJ talks about how this wouldn't have happened if Trump had been in power. I'm not sure, but Trump was removing the support of arms to Ukraine. So instead of being tougher than the current president on the Ukraine issue, he was less tough. Now, I might agree with the less tough approach to this because I think a way that this could have outcome could have been acceptable to the United States was to stop having an ideological position and to take a real politic position, and which would have led to a situation in which there would have been a neutral Ukraine, not a NATO Ukraine, and some other steps. But we can't talk to CJ about this.
No, well, you know, the insanity in talking to somebody who looks at it from the perspective of, well, they were afraid of Donald Trump. Russia wouldn't have never did this because they were afraid of Donald Trump. This is not two drunk guys in a bar having a fist fight. It is the most the two most armed nuclear arsenals in the world, and they require somebody using some common sense to somehow think that they were going to back down because of one guy, Donald Trump, is insanity, is the height of insanity.
Well, also, it just begs a factual observation of what the policies were, what they became. And, you know, I personally had a real politic view of this that was probably closer to the direction the Trump administration was on, but I don't think they were on that direction for the right reasons, and I'm not sure they had even reasoned it out.
Well, and again, to think that nations fear one man, right? Well, they're going to fear Donald Trump, him, individually. We're afraid of Donald Trump is ridiculous. Anyway, thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Sandy, as always. Great conversation, as always. We'll do it again on Friday. Thank you, Connor. I'll be back on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.